Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Donald Trump's presidency has ushered in a new period of suspicion in US-Russian relations. In February, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn resigned for misleading officials about his contact with Russia's ambassador to America before the presidential election. Earlier this year, BuzzFeed published an explosive dossier written by a former British spy with unsubstantiated claims that Russian intelligence had compromising material on Trump. Around the world, in Ukraine and Syria especially, Russia's hand seems hard at work. In a break from Australian politics, we're joined today by Associate Professor Matthew Sussex, Academic Director at the Australian National University's National Security College and a specialist in Russian foreign and security policy. Matthew Sussex, much has been written about the role Russia might have played in influencing last year's US presidential election. How damaging has Russia's meddling been?
Well, I think it's been exceptionally damaging, based on two scenarios. Scenario number one, Russia did it, and scenario number two, Russia didn't do it. Now, if Russia did do it, then this is an example of a very concerted, sustained attack by a hostile foreign power using a whole range of different means, from propaganda to social manoeuvring to what the Russians call compromat, or compromising material on elected and appointed officials. And that is damaging because it demonstrates that America is not untouchable, and that election results in the world's most powerful democracy can in fact be swayed. So it really does undermine confidence, I think. Now, let's say the Russians didn't do it. That is damaging in itself because everybody thinks they did. So it reinforces the view that the Russian security and intelligence organizations are omniscient and that their fingers are everywhere. So it's quite a significant force multiplier for Russia, whichever way you look at it.
Well, assuming that they did meddle, what would be the strategy?
Well, Vladimir Putin has personal hostilities with Hillary Clinton. He's reported not to like her at all. But beyond that, I think that the Kremlin was really dreading having a Hillary Clinton White House because she would have put up the pressure quite significantly on Ukraine, on Crimea, and on Russia's behaviour more generally. So I think it was very much in their interest to see Trump elected. And in fact, they were probably quite surprised that he was. Because
like everyone else.
Like everyone else, and shocked. Although they were shocked with champagne. The Kremlin side of it was that, well, Trump will deliver absolutely everything we want. And that was, number one, loosen NATO, which would give it a freer hand in Ukraine and not have to worry about its western flank so much. Second, to make America's allies pay more and make them more uncomfortable for the sense that they might be protected by the United States. And finally, and this is the big one, Trump has promised to wind back the liberal trading order, and it's widely perceived that this has been what's kept stability in our own region in the Asia Pacific, but also Europe as well, beginning with the TPP. And also Trump's desire to just negotiate bilaterally for trade.
Standing back and looking historically, this is just a very amazing situation for a US president, isn't it? How damaging do you think this could become for Donald Trump?
I think Donald Trump has significantly overplayed the Russia card, and that's certainly noticed in the Kremlin as well. Because he's been so keen, the one consistent line he's had is that he will reset relations with Russia and Russia should be a friend. Because there is so many links for his officials and possibly even Trump himself to the Kremlin, I think the big concern is that this could prompt a constitutional crisis. And even if you are sitting in Vladimir Putin's position, there would be a sense of buyer's remorse. That simply Donald Trump does not have the sophistication necessary to pull off the types of policy agendas that he's articulated.
But Putin can't lose out of this, can he?
No, I don't think Putin loses in the short term, but he could lose in the long term quite big. And that would happen if you get a big reversal in American public opinion and also a big reversal in American policy vis-a-vis Russia. There are plenty of Republicans and loads of Democrats who want a much more harsh line taken in respect to Moscow. And I think their worry is that, well, if Trump falls over or if Trump is pushed into the type of policy that the Republican right wants him to pursue, then the ramifications for Russia could be even worse than if Hillary Clinton had been elected.
And what do you think has driven Trump and some of those around him in this relationship with Russia? It seems quite odd when you think about it on many levels.
Yeah. Look, I'm a security specialist, so I would say that on one level at least, the strategic argument makes some sense, and that is that US-China relations have been looking kind of path-dependent, kind of hostile for quite some time. And the question is, well, does the United States really want to have a competitive China and also a competitive Russia as a Chinese ally? Do they really want to bifurcate the world like that? And so the argument runs that, well, if you can encourage Russia to be a bit of a middle player, then it can be an irritation to Chinese interests as well as to Western ones, and that's perhaps a good thing because it avoids the situation where China effectively gets to its north an 11 time zone buffer between itself and the West, and also a hell of a lot of raw materials. So in that sense, it is defensible. But in terms of the personal links that have emerged between Trump and Manafort and Flynn and all sorts of others with Russia, it really does make you worry that if this is not a Muscovian candidate, then it might be something close.
Now, we always think about the home turf. Would Russia have any interest in meddling in Australian affairs?
Well, Russia sees, on one level, no, because Russia sees Australia more or less as an American proxy and in a place of the world that is really far removed from some of the major security challenges. But on another level, you might say, well, yes, because Australia's seen as a useful test case of what the United States, what allies might do in response to the United States electing Trump, what they might do in response to Brexit, what they might do in response to the sort of changing power dynamics in Asia. A lot of the people I talk to from various agencies say that they worry very much that a lot of what they see in terms of cyber security issues is Chinese, but they're equally worried that a lot of what they might not see or think they see but don't know could be Russian. So there is an interest, I think, from Russia in any country that has a rules-based order approach to foreign policy rather than a strict statist one. And I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't some at least limited Russian support for those types of anti-immigration groups and far right-wing groups in Australia that would seek to adopt much more of a sovereignty line in Australian foreign policy.
Do we have to distinguish here meddling and spying? Because, of course, Russia over the years has sought to have a spying presence.
Mm. Meddling and spying are increasingly the same thing, I think. To an extent, it's nothing really new that a country might seek to change the foreign policy posture of another one. You can do it by diplomacy. You can do it by all sorts of other means. What's interesting, I think, is that the scope that it seems to be taking, and also the new instruments that are being used. So there's a lot of use of bots, there's a lot of use of Twitter, there's a lot of use of sort of social manoeuvring as a way to try and manipulate opinion. That's not espionage, but it can, in fact, if joined up with other aspects that are espionage, result in significant effects.
Let's turn to talking about President Putin, who comes across as something of an enigma, I guess. How large is his role in directing Russian foreign policy? Is he all supreme, or is it shared between other senior figures in the regime?
Look, the typical line about Putin that we read in the West is that he is a shadowy KGB man and that he is all-seeing and all-knowing, that Russian politics is centralised, it's autarkic, and Putin's right at the centre. That's not really the case. What happens in Russian politics is there are a whole bunch of different cabals or clans which compete for Putin's favour and his attention, and he's very good at keeping them on their toes and moving them around. So what happens with Russian foreign policy is that Putin would generally say, this is what I want, and this is whom I'd like to do it, and then he basically goes away while the rest of the department's implemented. It's only really if something goes wrong that Putin then steps in and tries to fix it. So in that way, I think he's a very good tactician. I don't think necessarily he's the master strategist that everyone paints him to be.
Is his grip on power still very strong? Are there any signs that he wants to step away from power anytime soon?
No. He will most likely run for what is supposed to be his final six-year tilt at the presidency, and would be highly likely to win that. If you look at the alternatives to President Putin, the field is relatively thin. And what's worse is that the alternatives are all much more rabid in terms of their nationalism and belief in the power of the Russian state than Putin. It's often not recognised that Putin, in fact, in Russian circles, is a moderate. And that you would, in many ways, rather deal with Putin than with some of his advisors.
Russia's been playing, obviously, a very big role in supporting the Assad regime in Syria. What are Russia's motives and interests in keeping him in power? And how important is the whole Syrian conflict to Russia's place in the international sphere?
The most commonly cited reason is that Russia has strategic needs in the Middle East and that it wants access to its Tartus base in Syria. Personally, I don't think that that is as significant as it's painted to be. I think that there are three reasons why Putin is so keen on propping up Assad. One is to send a message to dictators and leaders in the Middle East that Russia stands by its friends. Is to make the point that if you're Hosni Mubarak, if you're Muammar Gaddafi, then and you turn to the West, then you can be thrown under a bus. And Russia doesn't do that. So I think that's the first message it wants to send. I think the second message it wants to send is to make the United States look weak and silly and inept when it comes to managing what is just a horrendous humanitarian crisis, which plays, you know, very strongly for American public audiences, but Russia doesn't have that problem. And I think the third reason, and perhaps this is the most Machiavellian of them, is that by bombing in Syria, what you do is you effectively take out the middle ground that could generate a sort of moderate opposition to Assad. You force more people towards Islamic State, and you also force more people into fleeing their homes and keeping up that torrent of refugees into Germany in particular, but the EU in general. When that happens, it spurs far-right wing anti-immigration groups, and it puts a lot of pressure on people like Angela Merkel to change their policies. And I think that's quite consistent with Russia's strategic view of Europe.
Which is a very disruptive role, you're saying.
Absolutely. Russia initially wanted to join the common European home when the wall came down. Mikhail Gorbachev was keen on it even before then. I think that the Russians foresee, for whatever reason, that the West hasn't lived up to its promises, first by integrating it into the European trading zone, and then secondly, most importantly, by expanding NATO, which left it outside the European security system, and basically said to Russia, well, you can have a sort of half membership in NATO, everyone else gets a veto, but you don't. And there is an awful lot of resentment in Moscow that the West has said, oh, you're not really a threat to our security. But in reality, they actually do continue to view Russia in that way.
So do you think that the strains that the European Union is coming under at the moment feed positively into Russia's foreign policy outlook, what it wants to happen?
Yeah, the Kremlin, I think, would be much happier if the European Union was less than the sum of its parts And that if you had different groups within the European Union, whether it's a German-centred bloc or a French-centred bloc, emerge and perhaps vie with one another, it's in a way a kind of divide-and-rule strategy. On the one hand, Russia has some good strategic levers that it pulls repeatedly with Germany, because 40% of German gas comes from Gazprom. A more divided Europe politically is less likely to be very interested in what Russia is doing in the former communist countries, and less likely to be united in its opposition to Putin's policies, for instance, in the Donbass region of Ukraine.
If you were comparing Russia's policy and outlook today with the Soviet Union's in, say, the 60s, 70s, how would you characterise that comparison?
Well, lots of people have said that we're on the brink of a new Cold War between the United States or the West and Russia. I think Russian interests have remained relatively consistent. I don't think they've changed an awful lot. What has changed, I think, is the urgency with which Russia needs to accomplish its objectives. So whereas in the 1960s, you had the Cold War already in full swing, you had nuclear competition, you had Russia attempting to court the areas of the world where the West was weakest, i.e. the developing world, you see a slightly different emphasis in Russian policy now, where it confronts, both rhetorically and in military strategic terms, the West in Europe, but it doesn't really have the capacity to do so if push came to shove, the same way it did in the 1960s. So I think Putin is looking at Russia's strategic situation over the next 20 or 30 years, and I think he worries that Russia's on a downward trajectory. And I think that the reason why he worries about that is because of the rise of Asia, and also the fact that Russia will increasingly be pushed into a sort of raw materials appendage role with respect to China. If that's the case, then you could argue what he sees he needs to do is to garner as much treasure as he can to bolster his own idea about a Eurasian Union. And some of that is going to be in former communist states like Ukraine and also in Central Asia as well.
Is there some parallel here with the United States? Because in a sense, both are great powers that are fearing the rise of China, that China will become greater than either of them.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Russia has pivoted to Asia just like the United States under Obama pivoted to Asia. And they do that because they think that the global center of gravity economically and politically is going to be in the Asia Pacific. They have more challenges, I think, to overcome than the United States in their attempts to do that. The Russian Far East is largely underdeveloped. It's got an enormous amount of raw materials and resources, but they need lots of investment in infrastructure to make that happen and to bring it about. And for that, they're going to need Chinese investment, and they, as a result, worry about getting too close to Beijing.
What are the relations like now between Russia and China, and how do you see those evolving in the next decade, say?
Well, in the last 12 months or so, you saw Chinese troops marching in Red Square, that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. The Russians and the Chinese, I think, cooperate on more than just a skin-deep basis now. They hold joint exercises in the Mediterranean, in the South China Sea. They've announced a $400 billion deal on gas supplies. So on that level, there is a lot of cooperation. But I think the Russians are really worried about this. The Chinese have a phrase about boiling the Russian frog. So if you decide to boil a frog, you stick it in some tepid water, and it's very happy. And then you turn up the heat. The frog gets increasingly agitated and then panicked. But there's not very much you can do to get out of the pot. And I think the Russians recognise that this is the Chinese strategy, and I think they're very worried about entrapment.
Now, just finally, we were talking about comparisons with the old Soviet Union. Do you think Russia is now more or less ideological than it was? Is it these days really just acting as a great power? And secondly, how do you see things working out in the future? What direction do you think the regime will take? Will it become tighter, more authoritarian, or eventually more liberal?
Let me take the second part first. I think that there is very little at the moment in terms of what we'd identify as a sort of liberal intelligentsia within Russia. Partly that's because they can't access the media, but also partly because Putin remains incredibly popular. And even those parties that you'd identify as centre-left, centre-right, tend to agree with his foreign policy vision. And he's been quite clever in doing that. Going to ideology, I don't think Russia really has a central ideology that it can hang its hat on. It's had this thing called sovereign democracy as an alternative to Western democracy, but it really didn't get much traction globally, and it didn't get all that much traction in Russia either. I think both the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation have been very good at articulating certain ideas. Often that is ideas about Russian or Soviet exceptionalism that are basically underpinning a more statist foreign policy with fairly rational interests. As I say, I don't think the interests have changed much, but certainly the way they've gone about them has. What does this mean for the future? Well, I think it means a Russia that is still very uncertain, but one which will most likely retain a lot of its fairly authoritarian characteristics, kind of electoral democracy, with not much chance of alternative, more centrist, more democratic voices reaching power. It all depends, of course, on what happens when Putin steps down, because so much of Russian stability comes from his persona and his sort of cult of personality. That power vacuum may well prompt that kind of flowering, another colour revolution. But it's probably too soon to speculate about
that.
And
we'll be waiting for a while to see that.
Quite a while, yeah.
Matthew Sussex, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back again with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.